You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
Okay, everyone, welcome to the Pagoda, or welcome back if you've been here all morning, which I'm sure some of you have. Our next speaker is the renowned economist who predicted the 2007 global financial crash. She's written 5 books, the latest of which, The Global Casino, How Wall Street Gambles with People and Planet, is available in the bookshop. And also, Anne is going to be around to sign at 2 p.m., which is half an hour after this event ends. So please take that opportunity to go and meet her and get this book signed. She's going to be talking about financial inequality and what we can do about it. And she's mostly going to be taking questions. So think of questions. She's just going to do 20 minutes of speaking. And then the rest of the session is over to you guys to ask what you want to ask her. So please ask. And please also bear in mind 2 things. One is that, as ever, we're looking for questions, concise questions, and not long statements. And the second thing to say about that is that we are recording this talk. So if you don't want your voice to be recorded, then maybe don't ask a question. but you could ask it in the signing afterwards. Anyway, that's enough from me. I'm going to hand over to Anne.
Woo, thank you so much. I have to say I'm feeling a little bit emotional. I first came to Greenbelt in the 1990s when it was at the Cheltenham Racecourse, and it's just so wonderful to see so many of you here today. Frankly, I would rather be engaging in a Dolly Parton sing-along. I hope there's going to be a moment to remember Dolly Parton at this conference, because she was a wonderful human being. And I'm going to be talking about some human beings that are pretty damn awful. But first of all, can I say that I'm really honored to be here again, and thank you very much to Greenbelt for inviting me. I want to remember Ched Myers. Are there people here who remember Ched Myers, wonderful theologian, who once said that we read the gospel as if we had no money, and we spend our money as if we know nothing of the gospel. And he went on to say it's difficult to talk about economics within most Christian churches. He thought it was more taboo than even sex. We talk about sex far more than we talk about the economy. So there's nothing that has more impact on our lives than the economy, says Ched Myers, and I just want to echo that. And this book is about how the global casino impacts you and your daily life. And I've written it, I hope, in what I hope is an accessible form, because my mission is to explain all this stuff to people like me, you know, who aren't really that bright, actually. But anyway, not that my readers are not. My readers are very bright. But do you know what I mean? You know what I mean? Me, ordinary people like me. If I can understand it, then I can help you understand it. So this is what it's about, and it's about how the casino impacts us both in terms of our pensions, the food that we eat, the energy that we consume, and even the housing that we live within, or the housing within our country. And that's why we can't not talk about it. And it's quite hard to talk about the global casino because it ain't visible. It's not like you go down to the high street and there are banks, and there's big bad banks or good banks. But this casino is not, in that sense, tangible and within reach. And so it's very hard to understand what's going on there, or to understand it. And I'm determined that we should understand it. And I also know that it's not actually rocket science. Economists would want you to believe, and they use arcane names and all kinds of words to make it sound more complicated than it is. And I want to tell you that it's not rocket science. It's not difficult. Now, yesterday, Warren Buffett, whom some of you will know is one of the most powerful of the world's investors and the most successful, apparently, of the world's investors, called Wall Street a church with a casino attached. I imagine what he meant was the churches where people went to worship money and the casinos where they went to gamble. And I think that's a very good definition of Wall Street from one of the players inside Wall Street. So the point is the global economy is being run pretty much in the same way as Donald Trump ran his casinos. Some of you might know that he owned three casinos. It was called, I think there's the Casino Taj Mahal, there's the Casino Marina, and they were on the Atlantic City seaboard. And he bankrupted every one of them, not once, not twice, but five times. The last was bankrupted three times. And since I published the book in January, the global casino has become more corrupt. It has become more rigged than it ever was, even at, you know, in these last few months. So much more of that kind of mafioso-type capitalism is going onwards. So Trump is looting both the American economy, but also proposing, as he's warned this week, to loot the global economy. We've got a real problem with the way in which financial markets are gambling with our futures and creating the bubble of all bubbles and the bubble that is bound to implode not very long time from now. I can't precisely date when it could happen, but in my view, it's imminent. And it's going to be pretty disastrous. So that's happening in the financial sphere. In the fossil sphere, the fossil fuel owners and exploiters are betting that they can make as much money as possible before quickly the climate closes down the whole system. So they're just pumping out even more of their carbon emissions in the hope that they can carry on making those profits before the whole thing falls down. And that's a hell of a gamble with our future and with our people. And then there's the AI sector, Silicon Valley. They're a bunch of weird guys, if ever there was one. So they were part of the Doge team, you know, around Elon Musk, cancelled, closed down cancer research inside the Washington institutions on the grounds that they could develop AI, which would show us how to end cancer. And they're taking the same bet with the climate. They are betting that they can outrun the second law of thermodynamics, that before the ice caps melt, we must develop enough AI, we must build enough of their institutions in order to solve the problem of ice caps melting. That's the biggest gamble of all. Now, I don't want to just stand here and say the whole world is in a mess and it's all awful. I don't believe it is that. I believe that there is chances for us to actually address this problem. So a group of us back in 2008 drafted the Green New Deal. And I was very happy to see Zoe Williams this week in The Guardian reminding us of the Green New Deal. Because the Green New Deal is a positive answer to these cascading crises, these polycrises. It has a program of economic reform that is entirely doable, entirely within the power of our politicians and our institutions. If only they weren't so blindsided by the bureaucrats inside central banks and the economists inside government treasuries. Because one of the biggest lies we've been told of all time is that there is no money. Now, this is a lie, as any of you will know who've read any of my books, that money is not a commodity. It's not a thing that we can run short of, like we could run out of gold or silver or iron ore, because money is a social construct. It's a promise to pay. And this is where the churches come in, if you like. It's a promise to pay that has to be upheld by regulation, because we are weak as human beings and we're not good at keeping our promises. So we need that to be regulated. And most particularly, treating money as a commodity in a global system is utter madness, because it's very hard to regulate something that does not operate within the boundaries of your regulatory authorities. So our regulatory authorities, like our migration authorities, like our trade authorities, are all based here. And it's when you go across the boundary that you lose, if you like, oversight of financial activity. And so what happens is we are making decisions about money which affect not just us, but, for example, the people in Australia or in Brazil or whatever. And these have got exchange rates and interest rates and monetary policies quite different from our own. And so treating money as a commodity, as if you could trade money in the same way as you trade oil or food or grains, is what's profoundly wrong about the international financial system. All we have to now start doing is starting treating money as if it is something that operates within the enclosure of our own boundaries. And if we did that, we would begin to regulate the flow of capital across borders. And it's the flow of capital across borders which has caused the most instability in the global financial system. It is the thing which has led to the enrichment of the 1%. It is the thing which has impoverished the 99%. Why? Well, for example, Amazon can come to our country and do business here and make a lot of profits here and can take their profits, woof, across the boundary, across the border, and put them in a tax haven called Dublin or Ireland, right? So as a result, we lack tax revenues from these big, enormous corporates, which affects the people in our country, which affects our government's revenue and therefore the public debt and the public deficits. So we've got to manage our borders. We've got to manage our borders for all sorts of reasons. We've got to manage our trade borders. We don't want to be importing eggs from countries which have been contaminated and will give us salmonella. We don't, you know, we've got to be careful about that in exactly the same way we should be managing the flow of capital across borders. And that's a remedy to all of this instability, and that's in the Green New Deal. Now, everybody says that would be impossible to achieve in the current circumstances. But we achieved it in 1945 when the global economy was literally on its knees, where we'd had a catastrophic and devastating world war, and we'd had the 1920s and the 30s, which was a period of globalization that operated under the theme of the gold standard, but it was exactly the same as what we're going through now, right? And after all of that devastation, people pulled themselves together and developed the Bretton Woods system, which managed capital flows across borders, which managed trade, which restored stability. And the period between 1945 and 1971 is known by all economists on the left and the right as the golden age in economics. And that was because we managed our economy. We didn't leave our economy to something called the market, an invisible force out there which is intangible, unaccountable, and has never stood for election. So we can do this. We know that we can do this. We really are capable of changing our world. And my book is written to say, yes, together we can change the world. And I want us to be positive about that, because the world needs us to do this. The world needs us to think progressively about this crisis and offer a solution. So I want to end this contribution by quoting Ched Myers again, who gave us a poem from a fellow called William Garrison, who was the 19th century abolitionist. And he said, "God speed the year of Jubilee, the wide world over, when from their galling chains set free, the oppressed shall vilely bend the knee and wear the yoke of tyranny like brutes no more. That year will come, and freedom's reign to man his plundered rights again restore." Thank you very much. I'm going to end at that note.
Thank you so, so much, Anne. I'm sure we've got some questions cooking in people's minds already. I can see one over there. Tino's got the mic. Amazing.
Thank you very much. That was a great talk. I've got a quick question on regulation. I work for the FCA and with the FCA, and they clearly failed miserably to anticipate the 2007-2008 crash. What could you recommend as to how we can beef up our regulators to try to prevent a repeat?
It takes political will. It takes political will. In 1945, you know, a lot of regulators had gone to war, had died. Institutions had been allowed to age and you know, fall down. And we started from scratch again. So what it really requires is some wisdom and political will. And where does political will come? It comes from below. Political will, as we learned in the Jubilee 2000 campaign, is when the movement makes those demands, and out of those demands, you know, appears political power that's able to do stuff. So, I mean, that may sound a very general argument, but I think where there's a will, there'll be a way. We'll find those regulators. There are still people there with all of those skills, and there are young people that can be trained up. The question is, do we want to do it? That's all.
I think we've got another one over there as well.
I can't see.
Thanks, Anne.
Oh, there you are. Hi.
Are you really recommending that we go back to Bretton Woods, IMF and the World Bank? Because I thought that's what led to the debt crisis that we all campaigned about 25 years ago. Well, longer than that.
So Bretton Woods was not about the IMF doing what it does today. The Bretton Woods was about the IMF was to be a bank that was going to help Europe recover from the war. And it transformed itself into a body that serves, if you like, as the agent for global capital and directs capital at great expense to developing countries, to low-income countries. So, yes, I am recommending that we go back to Bretton Woods, or at least to the basis of the theoretical and the economic idea that underpinned Bretton Woods. But the IMF and World Bank that we have today is a monster that was not created at Bretton Woods.
Okay, great. Tino, where are you at? We've got one at the back. Great.
Oh, that's one. Hello. Hello, hello. Hello, Anne. Hello. I'm over here.
Hi.
I wanted to hear your thoughts on Varoufakis's techno-feudalism as an interesting but slightly controversial topic for people. Of the idea of like the current economic system moving towards a regressive type of top-down leadership, which is much more feudal than it is representative of like previous economic states from the last few decades. What do you think about that?
I think that's he's right about that, but I think that they're able to exercise that power precisely because of the economic architecture within which they operate. So they have been given that power by our governments that have said they can have the power to mobilize finance from across the world and to dominate finance across the world. We've transferred that power to them. I mean, right now, in the case of Silicon Valley, the American government is just sort of sitting on its hands and allowing these technocrats to run the show, design it, and to self-regulate their system. And we know self-regulation has never worked. So, yeah, Yanis is absolutely right. The question is what to do. What to do to curtail them? And the thing that will curtail them will be, number one, to regulate AI so that it is not as dangerous as it is, that it becomes a service for society, not, you know, destroying society. But most importantly, regulating their ability to mobilize finance across borders.
Just down here.
Thank you very much for your talk, Anne. What's your view on the wealth tax?
I'm strongly in favour of the wealth tax. I think we need to do a lot more than just the wealth tax. The problem with the wealth tax is their ability to move their money out of town, just like that. And so long as they're able to just shift their money abroad, it's quite difficult to impose that wealth tax. But absolutely we have to have a wealth tax. But we've got to do more to bring down the volumes of wealth owned by just this tiny, tiny proportion of people, percentage of people. Yeah. I see it as part of a package, not just on its own. And if we concentrated on it as if it were the only thing, we wouldn't be able to raise the amount of money we need to raise from it because, as I say, their money would just whiz across the borders and escape our tax collectors, essentially, in a way that, you know, we cannot escape the tax collector, the HMRCs.
Brilliant. And then just that.
Hi, yeah, thanks, Anne. You started talking about about money as a social construct.
Yeah.
If we look at a currency note, it's a promise to pay, as you said. In fact, if you look at the Indian rupee note, it's got 17 languages behind translating the number. So that is evidence that money is actually a cultural and religious construct. So therefore, my question is money a religious construct disguising itself as an objective science? Thank you.
Ooh. Woo, woo, woo.
I'm not sure that it's a religious concept, but I think what underpins it are, you know, religious, the Ten Commandments, essentially. Thou shalt not steal. You know, thou shalt not be greedy. I mean, there are values that underpin it that seem to me are profoundly faith-based values. Not just Christian, all faiths have these values. But money has now, if you like, broken out from and away from those values and operating as if it were a commodity. And so, in that sense, it's very far away from anything religious or from the values that underpin most religions.
Fantastic.
I was interested to hear your view on modern monetary theory and whether it has a role to play in the new economy you're describing.
So I think modern monetary theory has done an enormous amount to reveal to us the power that the state has to create money. And I'm grateful to those people for it. But unfortunately, it's a very American concept, and it's based on the notion that you can just print dollars ad infinitum. And that's not something, for example, that Malawi could do, or that South Africa could do, or that Britain could do. And in that sense, it's quite flawed, that theory. And it gives the wrong impression to our enemies, who argue that you're just going to print money and that's going to create inflation. And the whole thing about regulating is that you're making promises that you're able to keep, both, you know, in physical terms, but also, if you like, in economic terms. And MMT has run away with the idea you can just print money, and that's proved quite dangerous for people who've argued for it, advocated. Thank you for that question. It's a good question.
Hi, Anne. I was wondering how you think we should be implementing sort of finance education within like schools nowadays, because there's a lot of divide in how people approach money, especially young people now.
Yeah, that is a very big challenge, and there's a lot of ideology in economics, basically. You know, the very idea that there is no money, the very idea that if you tax the rich, they'll run away, they'll leave the country. There's a lot of ideological ideas that we have to challenge. So I think it would be hard. But the point is, you know, I remember when we started Jubilee 2000 back in the early 90s, everybody said, you can't teach, you know, international finance and sovereign debt and multilateral debt and bilateral debt and debt in real terms. And these concepts are too complicated to teach. And we showed that actually with an effective campaign, it was possible to explain to people and to educate people and to empower them in an understanding of the notion of international sovereign debt, so that they took action and they transformed the situation and debt was cancelled. So I'm a great believer in, you know, finding ways of pushing ideas out there into the atmosphere, if you like, but then for that to be caught on eventually in schools and in universities. But it's something that we have to probably do outside those institutions, first of all. Just in the same way when we argued for debt cancellation in the 1990s, we were laughed out of court. We were told it wasn't possible. We were told people wouldn't support it. We were told, you know, the governments couldn't do it. And it turned out they could, but it required a movement to do that. So we need a movement behind a more progressive economics, essentially, and an economics that is opposed to treating the economy as if it were a casino. And that's going to be tough. I'm not suggesting for a moment that it's going to be easy. Can I say that, you know, it's hard to do in these circumstances, in these conditions today. But it will be easier to do after a catastrophe, after we have another Great Depression and another World War. Then people will be far more open to these ideas, and we will be able to change the economics profession and the economic policies. But we don't have to go through another Great Depression and another catastrophic World War before we change the system. We do it through intelligence and wit and communication. Yeah.
Hi there. Yeah. Thank you. It's really hard, I think, for people to feel agency when faced with these global crises, like, you know, the lack of regulation of AI. One way that, of course, everybody, every citizen has agency is at the ballot box. How do you think that people should best exercise that agency to try to fix this specific problem that you're talking about?
I'm going to now repeat a story that I tell over and over and over again. Because you can imagine, back in the 90s, people would have said, how are you going to persuade Tony Blair and Gordon Brown to cancel the debts, right? And we said, well, it takes education and empowerment. And I have a moment in that campaign which has lived with me ever since, where a Treasury official comes up to me and he says, Anne, what the hell is going on here? And I said, no, what's the problem? He said, well, we're overwhelmed with correspondence from people. The chancellor's had to hire more people to deal with all of this stuff because there's, you know, coming from nowhere, there's just thousands of letters about this stuff. He said, do you know, it's even worse than that. He says, I get letters from women writing on a pink piece of paper with a bunch of roses in the corner. And she says, dear chancellor, I understand that under your proposals for debt relief, you've set the cutoff date for Uganda as 1982. I think that's outrageous when you know that most of her debt was incurred before that date. Please adjust those dates. He said, who the hell told her that Uganda's cutoff date was 1982? I said, we told her. It's not rocket science. But can you imagine that woman's agency, her empowerment, as she sat at her kitchen table and wrote that letter, and the chancellor was obliged to respond. And she was so empowered by that, she got off her butt and went to Birmingham in 1998 and lobbied the G8. That's the way I think it happens.
Okay. We've moved over to this side of the tent. We'll try and get through as many as we can. We've still got quite a bit of time.
Hi, Anne. I'm over here.
Where are you?
I'm over
Hello.
Here.
Hello. Yeah.
Other side of the tent.
Oh, right.
I'm down here. Hello.
Hi.
I think we're all agreed that, you know, preventing capital flight would be an excellent way of running our economy in this globalized world. If you could bend the ear of the Treasury, what specific model do you think would work the best? Would you prefer an American-style system where, you know, people are taxed through their lifetime after leaving a country? Would you prefer a one-time exit fee for people who try to leave the country? What's your kind of ideal model for, like I say, preventing capital flight?
So my ideal model would be China. China does not allow capital flight. China doesn't allow money just to flood into the country and inflate the value of their assets, right? China manages the flow of capital across borders. China doesn't say, there is no money. China has enough money to transform her energy system so that now she's almost totally dependent on clean energy, right? And she uses that with capital controls. That's the model. Why is China way ahead beyond all the Western economies in addressing climate breakdown? Well, for two reasons. The Communist Party cannot afford to have social unrest and to have social upheaval, right? Because they'd be out and they'd have a revolution on their hands. There's a lot of Chinese people. They can't afford that. So what they do is they manage their financial institutions, their central bank, to make money available for the transformation of the economy away from its dependence on fossil fuels. That would be the model. Why is China succeeding where we failed? Now, China is not exactly the sort of model that I would follow in other ways, and it's not a democracy, I understand all that, and they do all kinds of surveillance and wicked stuff. But in terms of managing money and managing the money for the nation and in the interests of China, she's superb at it. Plus, she stays out of wars, which has been quite helpful.
I think we've got one just right down in that far corner there.
Right. Hello.
Hi. I'm fully aware of the difficulties with the wealth tax. We're returning to a wealth tax. I'm sure you're aware of Richard Murphy's Taxing Wealth report. Do you think some of his solutions would be better solutions than a standard wealth tax?
I'm going to say that I haven't read that report, I'm afraid.
There, he's got quite a lot of different ways of taxing wealth, and he disagrees with a standard wealth tax. Just like you've just said, it's very, very difficult to impose it, and there'll be lots of people who can find their ways around it, and there'll be lots of arguments and legal things, but you can find it on the internet, and
sure.
I suggest that everybody else has a look at it too, because it's got a lot of great ideas.
So, I think he's probably arguing, that, for example, that it's best to tax fixed assets rather than... But the problem with that, and that is, of course, we must do, if they own property in Mayfair, then for God's sake, we must tax that wealth. But most of their wealth is intangible. Most of their wealth is not in fixed assets. That's the big problem. But I will look at Richard's report and see what he says. Yeah.
Yes, I understand you, Anne, to be saying that another capitalist financial crisis is imminent. In the last financial crisis, the Financial Times asked a rhetorical question. Was Marx right? What would be your answer to that?
Well... My answer would be that Marx was right about class forces, and I'm absolutely behind him on that question. But he didn't really tackle the finance sector and the financial system until Volume 3, which I think is mainly written by his friends. Anyway, he was good on class forces, but and he didn't live in the world that we live in today. We live in a world today, the reason why I think that a crisis is imminent is that Silicon Valley is spending something like $2 trillion a year and has income revenues of about $50 billion a year, right? It's, in other words, they massively are overspending and overinvesting, and there isn't the revenues to ensure that that gets paid. The question is, when do the investors that have lent money to Silicon Valley wake up to the fact that this is going to blow up? And the thing that worries me most about the next financial crisis is that thousands and thousands of the world's, they think of them as the little people, that have gone out and bought shares in Elon Musk's IPO, that proposed to buy shares in Sam Altman's IPO. A third of the US stock market is going to collapse when the AI bubble bursts, right? That is going to be devastating for probably millions of Americans. And if we want to prevent the rise of fascism, the very last thing we should do is to strip millions of Americans of their savings and of their hopes for the future. But that's what will happen when the AI bubble bursts. And that's why I worry about it as much as I do.
And then one just here.
Hi. One of my favorite slogans for the climate protests is, there's no growth on a dead planet. But that's the thing that politicians and big business keep going back to, that we've got to have growth. We've got to have growth. We can't do that because we've got to have growth.
Yeah.
What should we be answering to that statement?
I have a real problem with the word growth. So the word growth is devised by neoliberal economists to kind of envisage exponential rise in economic activity, right? And we're all against that because we know in terms of finite supplies of the ecosystem, we can't grow exponentially. That much is clear. But what is going to be needed for us to tackle a climate crisis, climate breakdown, is that we are going to have to do a lot more work. We are going to, for example, have to retrofit our housing. We're going to have to deal with floods. We're going to have to remake our agricultural system. And all of that is going to be hard graft. It's going to involve the employment, I hope, of an awful lot of British people. Plasterers, architects, plumbers, all kinds of people for retrofitting, all kinds of brilliant people for flood defences, all kinds of people to help us with regenerative farming, right? And that would create much more employment and generate much more income for those people. But ultimately also that employment generates income, but also tax revenues for the government to help pay down the borrowing. And so in that sense, I think we need expanded employment activity. We don't have to call it growth, but we do have to address the problem. We can't say, oh, we can't afford to work. We can't afford to be fixing the system in order to make our climate livable. We've got to fold our hands and say we don't want growth. I mean, I think we should drop the word growth, don't talk about it at all, but simply talk about what has to be done. And most of what has to be done is non-carbon emission activity. It's labouring back at home here rather than gambling in a global casino. So do you understand what I'm trying to say? I think we must just, and I don't like the term degrowth, because it actually, by framing it as a negative of growth, it actually reinforces the whole idea of growth. So let's abandon that completely and get back to say we've got to work. We've got work that has to be done. What is the most important work to be done? Let's do it.
And then just over here.
Hello, Anne. You mentioned earlier about money being transferred across borders. You mentioned money made in the UK going to Dublin. How are we ever going to end a situation where the world has loads of tax havens? Many of them are British territories, like the Channel Islands or... Yeah. Bermuda, how, in circumstances in which these tax havens continue to exist, how are we ever, how can the world's economic problem, like the world's, how can the world have an economic system that's fair for everyone when money that's made here in the UK by ordinary people is squirreled away to tax havens?
I don't want to sound like a broken record, but you know my answer. My answer is capital controls, I don't like the word control, management of capital flows. When we start managing capital flows, those tax havens are going to close down. They're not going to have the resources that are so willingly parked there at the moment. So that is the way in which to deal with tax havens. There's no point in going there. I mean, the British government is guilty. We're as much a tax... London is as much a tax haven for some people, for Nigerian dictators or ex-dictators, for Russian oligarchs and so on. London has proved a very lucrative tax haven. We've got to stop them being able to do that. And that will kill off the tax havens ultimately. Thank you.
I think we'll take one more from this side of the room and then move over to the other side.
Right.
Tent, not room.
Where? Where are we?
Still there, just to the back there.
Hello, Anne. Hi. Thank you very much for your talk. What advice would you give to the Canadian Prime Minister with his negotiations with his noisy neighbour?
I want to celebrate the Canadian Prime Minister. I have at times been rude about Mark Carney and his role as Governor of the Bank of England, but I have to say he's done a blinder here. He has blocked all government contracts which involve American corporations. He has resolved to divert all of their exports away from the United States and towards Asia. And thirdly, so he's cancelling contracts like the contract with Elon Musk for satellites. I think it's fantastic, actually. And he is, and then finally, he's blocking the export of crude oil to the refineries on the boundaries between Canada and the United States. And the Americans are trapped. It's just been the most brilliant maneuver, you know. I mean, he's like a general who spent obviously a year or two thinking about this, and starting off by being polite to the brute in the White House. And then he's come up with the strategy. And of course, the Canadians are all behind him. And I think while we're all excited by this, is because he's put up a fight, right? He's actually resisting a fascist. And do we see our governments doing that? No. And that's what's so exciting about what he's done. Here, right.
Given the acknowledged difficulties of taxing the really wealthy, isn't a wealth tax just code for impoverishing the middle classes?
For what for?
For impoverishing the middle classes.
I think if the middle classes are wealthy, then they should be willing to pay taxes if they want to live in an economy where we provide public services which benefit everybody.
Okay, and just over here.
Thank you. At the beginning, you were concentrating very much on controlling the flow of finance across international borders.
Yeah.
But my question is, what are your key points, the two or three main things, in the ways in which you want to do that control? You said it should be like China, but can you spell it out a bit more, right, please?
So the capital controls are just taxes. You're just taxing the flow across borders. It's the Tobin tax. Did you remember hearing about the Tobin tax? So when you think about when Mark Carney was governor of the Bank of England, London house prices were going through the roof. So he introduced a capital control. He said that any foreigner investing in London property had to put down a bigger deposit than locals have to put, a bigger share of the loan as a deposit than locals have to put down as a deposit. That's a capital control. That immediately cooled the housing market in London, and foreign investors immediately responded by not jumping into that market. So that's just one way. It's called a macroprudential tool if you're a central banker. There are ways of doing this, and they can be as gentle as Mark Carney's one, which was done, and nobody even talks about, you know. And it was very successful. So, yeah, that's the way you would do it. It's a form of taxation of money flows across borders. And, you know, the problem, everybody, the other problem, which you haven't raised, but many people raise, oh, we've got a digital economy, computers, et cetera, et cetera. Don't worry, we know how to deal with that too.
And then still on this side here.
Hi, Anne, Daniel here. Thank you. I just wonder whether you had opinions about some of the models which have encouraged...
Where you are, Daniel. Oh, there you
Hi.
Are.
Hi, yeah. Sorry. Where countries have used incentives to encourage people, particularly institutions, to channel money in the right way. So I'm thinking of the French Fonds Solidarity Fund, which has enabled 30 billion euros of ordinary pension savings to go into social sector organizations in France, and also the Community Reinvestment Act in America, and just whether or not we could, or many other countries could use those kinds of models to channel the right things rather than just stop the bad things happen.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the thing that I'm most resentful about what happened after 2007-9 is that we bailed out the banks. Now, I happen to think we should have bailed out the banks, because you and I would not have been able to go to a machine in the wall and draw cash if we hadn't done that. So I'm in favor of that. But we did it unconditionally. We should have said, we will bail you out, but thou shalt invest in this economy and not abroad. Thou shalt support new startups. Thou shalt pay your taxes, right? But instead, our governments, and at the time Gordon Brown was finance minister, were just so glad to invite those bankers into the Treasury. And the bankers came into the Treasury and said, look, let's just show you how we can do this more efficiently than we did it before 2007-9. And so this, the financial system, rather than being tamed, in fact consolidated itself, and it's now bigger and badder and more powerful and more impactful than it would have been if we had set conditions after 2007, 8, 9. So that's our problem, you know. These institutions constantly need help. The French understand that there is a deal being done here, right? You're coming into my country, I have a rich culture, I have an educated workforce, I have resources here that you can't find in other countries. You can have access to those resources, but these are the terms and conditions. And our problem has been spineless politicians who argue, we just want capital inflow. Please bring your money and buy up all our housing because we ourselves can't afford to build our own houses. Isn't that ridiculous? Isn't that absolutely awful? So private equity have moved into the housing market, and they're buying up whole housing estates, and they will extract rent from those housing estates and transfer it to Wall Street, and we'll all complain about very high rents and about unaffordable housing and about a shortage of housing. It's unbelievable how weak our politicians have been in the face of global capital. And it needs you guys to go and stiffen their spines. Right, yeah.
Thank you. So this kind of follows on from that. What can we do as very ordinary, normal, day-to-day people?
Well, I think the very first thing, may I just say... The very first thing is to understand what's going on and kind of learn about it and read the Financial Times, for goodness sake, or find ways of finding out about what, because the web is now amazing for us. Go on to YouTube and there's all kinds of talks you can find and learn about. By the way, I think I'm going to start a podcast, so there you go.
You had it here first.
So the point is that... we've got to educate ourselves and we've got to understand. And that's what I learned from Jubilee 2000. It's so empowering when you know what's going on. You can start talking about it. You can start talking about it to your neighbors. Eventually, you get the courage to write a letter to your MP. The next thing, you're talking to your MP. The next thing, you're putting pressure on your MP, and you've got your friends to put pressure on your MP as well. And suddenly, everybody else is talking about it, and the newspapers are talking about it. So that, for me, it's slow and hard, but that's the way we're going to have to do it.
Hello, thank you very much for your talk. With introducing sort of policies to manage capital flows,
yeah,
is there a risk that you sort of suddenly reduce the demand for the pound and therefore the value of the pound and sort of create a higher price for imported goods and therefore general inflation?
Yeah, so this is a problem that Keynes faced in the 1940s with sterling and the determination of sterling's value by global financial markets, which had been the way things worked before the Second World War. And so he, by introducing capital controls, empowered the Bank of England to manage the exchange rate, and more importantly, and this is something I really want to say to this group here today, more importantly, to manage the rate of interest. Now, I'm obsessed with the rate of interest, because the rate of interest is a tool for extracting wealth from those that do not have wealth, right? I'm a rich creditor, and that bloke needs to borrow money for his project, and he hasn't got the money, and I have the power and the money, and I'm going to lend him the money, but I'm going to extract not just what I've lent to him, but more, and I'm using the rate of interest for the extraction of that wealth. Now, the thing about the rate of interest is that it rises arithmetically like this. It goes in that direction, almost exponentially, right? But work and nature and life doesn't grow like that, right? And we don't make money like that. We don't earn money like that. And so as the rate of interest rises, so the power of extraction of both the financial and economic assets of people, but also ecological assets. You know, if Brazil is to repay its debt, then it must strip the Amazon forest. Then it must fish the seas, then it must degrade the land and grow soybeans, right? Because it has to repay debts that rise almost exponentially thanks to very high real rates of interest charged to those countries. And I think Christians should make the rate of interest and use the sin of usury fashionable again. We don't talk about the sin of usury, but this is usury. This is a word that in the Bible was unacceptable until quite recently, and until capitalism eventually actually abolished the use of the term, effectively killed off the use of the term, because it is so extractive, the rate of interest. Now, I'm not sure if I'm answering your question, because I can feel I'm on a rant here. So have I answered your question? No, 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 right, maybe not.
Sorry, one more here. Got one here?
Yeah.
I'm a fairly simple bloke, and as you claim to be a simple woman, yeah. Aren't we all going to burn together? Won't the super rich burn as well? I mean, a few claim that they're going to space or something. Isn't the climate crisis a real opportunity, not only to work on that, but to have a more humane economic system as well?
Absolutely. And I refuse to burn together. I don't think we should even be thinking about that. We should be using our power, and we have power. You know, the way to disempower yourself is to believe that you don't have power. We all have power, and we should use that power to ensure that we don't get to the position where that happens. Now, I know it's pretty damn serious when we're watching Nepal, and the glaciers are collapsing. This is clearly a result of heating the earth and clearly a result of the stocks of carbon that are already out there in the atmosphere that we can't do much about, really. But even at this late hour, you know, I always think of Churchill in the 1930s. Churchill walked around telling people that Hitler was proposing to invade Britain and Hitler was proposing to destroy Europe, essentially. And nobody believed him. He was expelled from the Tory party. He was marginalized. It was very humiliating for him because he was a very arrogant bloke, actually, and he wanted to be part of the establishment, and he was pushed to the margins. But he was right. And when they woke up too late. But then they rushed around, and they prepared themselves, and they fought a bloody long war and defeated Hitler, right? Now, we don't have to get ourselves into those sorts of difficulties. We've got to get prepared well before. We've got to do a Churchill, even at this late stage. You know, it took it to about 1938 or 39 before he was actually finally listened to. And only then did we begin to prepare for what was one of the gravest threats ever to face this country. So, yeah, let's not give up.
We'll take one more from this side of the room, and then, Tina, can you move further over for the final few? Thanks.
Hi, thank you very much. Hi, thank you so much for sharing all of your thoughts. I'm curious to know if you have a sense of hope that the change that you feel is necessary will be done in time, and if so, what's the source of that hope?
I have hope, and you are the source of that hope. It's as simple as that, you know. I want us all to be Dolly Parton in a world full of Donalds. Hi.
I know that the out-of-the-box economic thinkers are not the economists.
Yeah.
That in the education of our economists, they're mostly taught the Keynesian theory, but I also know that there are some growing alternative economic theories, such as the capability approach.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just wondering whether you see them having any momentum in the official field of economics.
Yeah, and you know, you've hit a raw nerve there because I'm a Keynesian. But my view is that Keynes has been abused and what is defined as Keynesianism, and the economists who call themselves that are called New Keynesians, and they're not Keynesians at all. My mission and the mission of my colleagues that I work with at Policy Research in Macroeconomics has been to restore the real truth about Keynes. Keynes is depicted as a man who was in favor of taxing and spending. And the right liked to use those terms. And also that he wanted, a massive expansion of economic activity beyond the limits and the finite limits of the economy. And that is the very opposite of his theory. He was primarily concerned with monetary policy and managing the monetary system. And today, if you talk about economics in Britain, you talk always about fiscal policy. Everything is about fiscal policy matters more than anything else. Nobody talks about monetary policy. And monetary policy is where the power lies. That's where Wall Street exercises its power, through central bankers, essentially. And we tend to ignore it and focus on taxation and fiscal policy. Now, Keynes was against that completely. The point about taxation, and this is something I really hope you would understand, is that taxes do not fund our expenditure. I know that might sound wrong to you, but I tell you it's completely wrong. Taxes are a consequence of investment. You don't get taxation unless you invest in employment and economic activity, right? If you don't invest in employment and you raise people's incomes and so on, you get less in back in the way of tax revenues, and you build up a debt and a deficit. And that was what Keynes argued. He argued that in the 1930s, when there was high unemployment, there was also high debts and deficits. To bring down the deficit, you had to put employment up. And how did you do that? Well, you used the monetary system to inject finance into the economy to invest and create jobs and generate income and revenues, which would then pay back for the borrowing. You used the monetary system for that purpose. And above all, you kept interest rates very, very low. His great achievement was through the war, he financed Britain's fight against the war on very, very low rates of interest. The general theory is called the general theory of employment, money, and interest. That's what he was about. So I just want to, respond to you. It's not Keynesianism. But it's very hard to disentangle these guys that call themselves new Keynesians. Now, as to those alternative radical economists, most of them, I think, are very sound and say a lot of good things about the way the economy should be run. But how many of them talk about the monetary system, the financial system? And the fact of the matter is we're going to need a functioning monetary system. If you go to Malawi, which is what I've had to do as part of my work, Malawi is a country that has no money. It has no money because it doesn't have a monetary institution that could manage its money. It doesn't have a central bank that it trusts. It doesn't have accounting systems. It doesn't have a sound tax collection system, which is part of the monetary system. It lacks all of these institutions, public institutions, that provide an economy with money, right? So what does it do? It brings in somebody else's money, US dollars. It has to import US dollars to pay for health, to pay for building housing, to pay for basic fundamental things. But those dollars are priced in somebody else's monetary institutions and at somebody else's interest rates, right? And that crucifies Malawi. So, what the IMF, the bad old IMF, should be doing is helping Malawi build monetary institutions that would enable her to create her own money and not rely on foreign money to finance economy. So that's what's so brilliant about what Keynes argued for. So we've got to, if we're thinking radical economics, we also have to think about monetary systems. And I'm beginning to fall apart here.
Yeah, I think, to be honest, that is, unfortunately, all we do have time for. But thank you so, so much, Anne.
Thank you. Thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts for free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.